This summer, saddle up with the only sportsbook where you can bet on horse racing, FanDuel. Right now, new customers can get a no-sweat first bet up to $500. Just download the app or go to FanDuel.com/horses to score your no-sweat bet up to $500. 21 plus and present in Ohio. Offer valid on first real money wager of $5 or more. Verified FD racing account required. Bonus issued in non-withdrawable racing site credit that expires 7 days after issuance. Max refund $500. Restrictions apply. See terms at racing.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the major stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up on today's show, electoral shocks, whether it's the far right in France or Jacob Rees-Mogg's losing his seat or even Trump winning in 2016. It seems nearly impossible to really know what any future election is going to throw up at us these days. So I'm going to be talking to Geoffrey Evans, who's the co-author of a book called Electoral Shocks, The Volatile Voter in a Turbulent World. And at this week's NATO summit, all eyes were on President Biden following a disastrous TV debate. So today we're going to assess how he did and what NATO's standing is in the world now, and has it got support from its allies? And finally, we're going to talk all about supply chains. During COVID, supply chains were constantly in the news, but have things settled down now? A new report from PwC tells us that supply chains are actually becoming much more localised. So they'll be here to talk about that. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. So let's start with that issue of supply chains. A new global supply chain report has just been published by PwC, and it's identified some very interesting trends on the future of supply chains. And I'm joined now in studio by Mark McKeever, who's Director of Procurement and Supply Chain Practice at PwC. Hello, Mark. Thanks for coming in studio.
Thanks a lot, Mandy. Thank you.
Now, supply chains kind of hit our psyche and the headlines and our pockets kind of during COVID for the first time. And then we had that Suez Canal issue. So we all became very proficient in knowing what was happening around supply chains and how important they were. Those big type of issues that we saw happening during COVID and that, are they all solved now, would you say?
Yeah, so maybe if you take each in turns, I think COVID, that in itself from an operational perspective has probably worked its way through. I do think the one area that's still kind of challenging coming out of COVID is balancing supply and demand. So let me give you an example. If you take the bike sector, the bikes, during COVID, there's a massive swing in bike sales. Everyone wants to cycle a bike. And then if you think about COVID, we couldn't produce bikes, prices went up, hard to get. However, now that we've come out of COVID, production of bikes has ramped up, but yet demand has kind of tapered off. So suddenly now you've got a glut of bikes in the market. So I think that's an example of where supply-demand balancing, there's probably still a bit of a hangover.
Yeah, I read a bit about that once before, the phenomenon of lack of supply and oversupply, and then that when the demand is there, there's a rush to overproduce, and then they pull back from that. So it takes a bit of time to settle it down. But back to the report, Mark, the trends that you're seeing there, what did the report actually tell you?
Yeah, I think, I mean, maybe just give a little bit of context to the report, because, I mean, the report, as you mentioned, is done in a context of a huge amount of disruption in the supply chains at the moment. So obviously we got the kind of the impacts of kind of COVID, you've then had the Ukraine war, you've had energy crisis, and even before that, the Japanese earthquake. So it just seems to be one crisis after another. And now right now we're in the Suez Canal crisis. So that's kind of first dimension going on. Then secondly, you've got ESG. And there's a huge amount of new requirements and legislations coming out in terms of ESG. So that's putting more and more pressure on companies.
And just explain to people why ESG would be important for, or why it would be putting pressure on companies.
Yeah, I think from a supply chain point of view, I'll just take it from that particular focus. I think there's two challenges with ESG. One is, how do I decarbonize my supply chain in terms of how I source products, how I manufacture products, and how I distribute products? So that's the first challenge, how to decarbonize. The second challenge then, which is really high on the list of priorities, is how do I report on that and how to provide transparency on it? So if you look at a lot of the European legislation, like the new German Supply Chain Act, DORA, you've actually got to report on your supply chain activities. So that reporting and creating the systems to do that is a huge challenge. And actually, it's quite interesting. If all the initiatives going on at the moment in supply chain, ESG, what we found in the survey was like 65% of companies have got initiatives around ESG.
Mm.
So it's a number one thing driving transformation of supply chains.
And on the ESG front for companies, okay, it's not just because everyone wants to be green. It's because there's an incentive here for a business now to be green and to be sustainable and do the right thing coming from Europe, as you say. So is it the case that people are, like businesses are taking a while to get their act together on this, or it's just another concern for business?
I think it's a massive concern. It's probably, there's been driven by two factors in particular. I think one, with that EU legislation, you know, there will be fines coming down the road. So if you cannot comply with EU regulations, you do risk getting fined. So that's the first one. So it's a real financial motivation. But the second one, and actually which is probably even driving more change, is pressure from your customers. So let me give you an example. Like, we'd one client that would supply into a huge retailer in North America. And for them to continue to supply to that retailer, they had to be able to prove their ESG credentials. So we were helping them come in to develop an ESG policy and strategy. So again, that's just an example. And more, if you want to sell to particular companies now, as you go on through the onboarding process, you've got to be able to prove your ESG credentials. So, that's driving change.
It would be a bit like having a tax clearance certificate, that you just need an ESG certificate now.
Exactly.
Right, okay, I got it. So back to the report, what are the other bits and pieces that you found out about it when you looked at this as a kind of an issue? Like, how many of the respondents felt that supply chain disruption might be an issue in the future?
Yeah, I mean, what was really interesting is, like, I mean, 60% of best-in-class companies are saying they're really concerned about future disruptions.
And why are they still concerned? Is it because geopolitics is so unstable, or is there a particular reason? It was just scarred from the last round of supply chain issues.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors. So absolutely, the geopolitics is huge. The risk of potential new tariffs coming down, potential new sanctions coming down. So that's definitely driving change. But also, you know, there's risks around, are there going to be new ESG requirements coming out? New technology coming out is a huge concern as well. How do I manage new technology? And particularly if my customers are adapting to new systems, do I have to adapt with them? So that the rash of new technology is coming down. And probably the other element that really came out in the survey, and we see it here in Ireland with our clients, is shortages of labour. So, like, for example, like, I mean, I've been talking to a client who's saying, listen, we're really struggling to get just basic warehouse staff, logistics staff. So that scarcity of labour, it came true in our survey very strongly, and I can actually see it here on the ground when I talk to clients.
Really? I mean, we're at full employment here in Ireland. You know, you talked about technology trying to help. You know, AI, is that a role to play in trying to move people toward guarding against supply chain issues in the future? I'm looking at that figure that you say, how many people are worried and concerned about supply chain issues happening in the future, but then only 8% of industry leaders have fully transformed their supply chains. So half of them are worried, but only less than 10% have done anything about it.
Well, yes. Yeah, so I think maybe just take a step back. So I think what we're saying is, of best-in-class companies, 8% have fully transformed their supply chains to meet these kind of disruptions.
Okay.
So that's great. But I think if you look at the initiatives, like, I mean, like 52% of companies have got initiatives ongoing at the moment to meet kind of severe disruptions in the future. Another 65% are kind of working on ESG initiatives. So I think a lot of companies are kind of working to transform their supply chains and get them future-proof.
And when you say those 10% almost who are best in class and who have transformed it, what do they do to guard against future shocks on the supply chain front?
Yeah, I mean, there's a myriad of strategies. To give just a couple of examples that are most prevalent, I think a lot of companies are starting to more regionalize their supply chain. So, you know, in the past where you might have had like an over dependence on producing goods from the Far East, I think more and more of that coming into regional. And that rebalancing is giving you protection. I think secondly, people are investing in new technology, particularly around areas like control towers, which just gives you that end-to-end vision of, you know, where your stock is across the supply chain, much better controls in place. I think we're seeing a lot of investments there. I think the third kind of area is there's a lot more closer collaboration between companies, its core suppliers and its customers, sharing data and therefore just getting much more protection that particular way and getting much more of that end-to-end visibility.
Mm.
So I think there are some of the examples of what companies are doing to protect themselves.
And what about AI? Where does that fit into all of this?
Yeah, I think that's going to be huge. Like, I mean, like 39% of respondents said, look, that's going to have a really high impact over the next kind of 10 years. Another 41% will have a medium impact. So you can actually see the impact. It's definitely going to be there. I think with AI, we're still at the very early stages. It was interesting. I've just come off a call with a client this afternoon just asking about AI and procurement. So I think clients are just kind of getting their heads around it at the moment. They're starting to try it out. I think the key one is use cases. More and more use cases come in, you will see more and more of AI. So for example, just to give some examples, like, you know, if you're procuring goods from suppliers, you can use AI to actually help you screen suppliers. So have they met minimum requirements? You can use AI in terms of drafting contracts and helping you starting to draft contracts. So those use cases are coming through. So I think as more and more use cases come through, you'll see more and more clients adopt it.
And you're using it as a filtering process in the same way lots of people now would experience AI if they're applying for a job or something. You're not getting through if you don't have the minimum requirements and stuff.
Exactly, exactly. It's a really good
example.
Becoming
more and more prevalent. Yeah, we spoke about when the supply chain issues were acute just after COVID and that Suez Canal issue was happening. We spoke to somebody from the Financial Times at the time who predicted that nearshoring for supply for industries would be a huge part of the recovery, and that actually indigenous companies would benefit from that. Are you seeing that in this, where the suppliers are nearshoring and localizing their supplies in Ireland?
Yeah, I think,
or maybe not in Ireland. This is a global study, but it's just as a phenomenon. Do you see?
Yeah, maybe we just take a step back. So start from kind of at a European level, even as exact same. Actually, by the way, in Mexico, if you look at Mexico, like Mexico's share of U.S. imports has increased dramatically. Actually, Mexico's now overtaken China in that side of the world. If we look in our side of the world, I mean, a lot of the kind of, can you use the word, kind of lower cost, whatever, more basic manufacturing. Some of that,
like what would be an example?
I'll give you a classic example, clothing.
Okay.
So that'd be a classic example. And what you see is, like, you know, a large clothing retailer, for example, what they might do is they might move some of the production to either Southern Europe or indeed into kind of Eastern Europe. They'd be the two most popular locations. And what they're trying to do is they're actually very smart. They'll say, like, if I take something like a basic white t-shirt, they know the sales of that, it sells the same exact amount every year, it's low cost, they'll probably continue to produce that in the Far East. But the more higher fashion items that are kind of a higher price point, more unpredictable demand, I don't know what my demand is going to be, they'll start producing that closer to their markets. And that gives them a real benefit because they can react faster to consumer demand. And even though it might cost them slightly more to produce, they will actually save in markdowns. So there is a little bit of kind of equilibrium going on there.
And more sustainable, I guess.
Exactly. More sustainable from the ESG perspective as well, which adds to it. So I think that kind of manufacturing you're absolutely seeing coming into kind of, you know, particularly, say, Southern Europe, Eastern Europe. I think from our side of it, I mean, like, our strengths are very much kind of around pharma, medtech. And I think we can continue to drive in those areas. Obviously, at the moment, we do have some limiting factors, like housing has been, and infrastructure is a challenge. But, you know, I can absolutely see more opportunities.
My final question on this about the supply chain practice is about trade wars. Look, we heard the NATO summit this week and things seem to be ramping up against China. Like, and we have that consideration about what might happen after November. Where do they feature when you're looking at something like supply chains? Do you take that future geopolitical climate or landscape into consideration?
Yeah. I mean,
is that a concern for people?
Absolutely. And it's coming through. So I think it's probably coming through in two perspectives. I mean, one, when we speak about regionalization, obviously China's a huge concern of what's going to happen down there. In the very, very short term, and if you look at exactly what's happening now, and you mentioned at the top of our discussion around the Suez Canal, you know, one of the drivers of the chance of moving, if you look at Singapore, the port there, it's actually, it's at capacity at the moment, there's congestion there. And what's actually happening is a lot of companies are suddenly trying to fast forward orders in from China because there's concern new tariffs are going to come on board. And what's happening is between that and then you're getting into kind of peak demand, you've still got the Suez Canal crisis having to go around the Cape of Good Hope. When you pull all that together, the cost of shipping products from Eastern Europe, sorry, from the Far East into Europe has whacked up. So it's gone from, it was about 1,600 a container a year ago. It went up to about 5,000 a container around February, and now it's up at 7,000 a container. So you can see just at a practical level, the impacts of something like tariffs can have.
I always love talking about supply chains because I think you can see the footprint of politics always and business all over it. Exactly. Well, so that was fascinating. Mark, thank you very much for coming into studio today. That was Mark McKeever, Director of Procurement and Supply Chain Practice at PwC Ireland. Thank you.
Super, thank you.
You're listening to Taking Stock here on News Talk. After the break, we'll be talking about election shocks and why they'll always be with us. You're welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, it's been just over a week since Labour's resounding win in the UK election. My next guest has been following trends in voting in a professional capacity as co-director of the British Election Survey for years. He's also one of the authors of a book called Electoral Shocks, The Volatile Voter in a Turbulent World. Geoffrey Evans, I am delighted to welcome you to Taking Stock today.
Okay, thanks.
Now, before we get into what's been happening in the electoral universe this year, lots and lots of elections going on around the world and in the UK, maybe just go back to that book that you wrote, Electoral Shocks, The Volatile Voter, with your colleagues. What did you look at when you were setting about analysing voter trends at that time, and when was it?
Okay, we wrote the book in 2019 and examined evidence from 1964 until 2017 on the pattern of volatility in British electoral behaviour. And what we see is a dramatic increase in the willingness of voters to shift from one party to another, or maybe from a party to not voting at all during that period, which completely changes the nature of what parties can do and how vulnerable they are to new parties breaking into the system. Mm. And so we were looking at electoral shocks, which were kind of serious events such as the fiscal crisis of 2008-09 and Brexit and the immigration crisis in Britain that emerged during the late noughties and early teens, and several other examples of dramatic things which at one time may not have really transformed the party system. They may not have led to voters really shifting around so much. We had an immigration crisis back in the 60s and 70s. It had very little effect on parties. Mm. But now we've seen a loosening up of the party control of what goes on and a growth of voters who actually will shift and leave. They don't have these affections to parties, these strength of affiliation that they used to have. So they will move off, and if a new thing comes along, or if the party moves away from where they are, they will just depart one way or the other. So that's sort of the game's changed. Voters are responsive. Shocks and the way that parties react to them have big consequences for what voters then do. Mm. I've seen that now, obviously, in 2024 as well.
Absolutely. 7 years on, it's not a phenomenon that has dissipated. It's actually, increased. And we'll come to that in a second and what's your analysis of things and how they stand now. But there was a very interesting example, I suppose, of that voter volatility in a particular constituency on the northeast coast of Britain, which you might perhaps go through for us, which demonstrated how very different parties were successful in one constituency. Redcar.
What's happened in Redcar is you're going to see Redcar's the sort of traditional old Labour place.
That's right.
Which was left behind by, especially the moves by Blair in the noughties to make Labour a more electable for middle-class voters and business interests. And that sort of place, and also a far more socially liberal place, and, with the encouragement of EU immigration en masse, which had not existed prior to 2004. And so Redcar would be the place where people felt betrayed and left out. And sometimes people use the term left behind. Mm. And they obviously, immigration is a big issue for them. The Labour Party wasn't really doing what they cared about on that. The Conservatives came along and they pushed the European vote. And that obviously didn't work out for David Cameron. And what we see is basically, we've seen a move from, basically what we saw in 2019 is Boris Johnson came along and very effectively smashed what was then known as the Brexit Party, who withdrew from many competitions. Mm. So they compete with the Tories. And of course, still in a very pro-Brexit vote. And he got these sorts of seats. He was able to get these sorts of seats, a grand sweep. And I come from Stoke-on-Trent, which is an incredibly poor industrial city in North Midlands, south of Manchester. Massively Labour forever. All four seats went to the Conservatives by 2019. All four seats. All four seats, it must be said, are now back to Labour.
Wow. That volatility within the electorate, you've went through some of the shocks that caused that volatility. But is there any evidence in your research that shows who actually benefits from the volatility? So, for example, you mentioned there it has swung entirely from Conservative seats in Stoke-on-Trent to Labour. Is there a pattern, I suppose, of where that volatile vote goes to? Or does it just depend on a circumstance at a particular time?
I would say the latter. But, I mean, in recent times, it's been a particular type of voter that's been most of interest, and which is what they call the red wall voters, or possibly you might say more working or lower middle class voters who are, you know, concerned about immigration and the like, but also more recently, very much concerned about their standard of living and economic security. And so these are, as it were, they used to be pretty much solidly Labour. And voting back, say, in the 70s or 80s, there was very little evidence of the same degree of calculation or as it were, you know, voters switching on the basis of issues. Got more so over time. And of course, a key thing is, if you leave an issue out of the set of things that are being considered by the main parties, and this is the case with like Brexit and also immigration, which was pretty much ruled out of discussion for quite a long time, you get a build-up of people who feel that politics isn't for them. And then you get the opportunity for parties like UKIP, or more recently Reform, to muscle in on that. And the Conservatives tried to be, as it were, they grasped the Brexit nettle very firmly, especially under Johnson. And, you know, they ran with it and did very well. But then, of course, immigration's gone through the roof since Brexit. We know that a lot of people's motives for voting to leave were probably concerns about uncontrolled EU immigration. Mm. But since then, immigration has doubled, not from the EU, of course, mainly from India, Nigeria, Pakistan, and China. And those people are just looking at the Conservative Party, being completely betrayed by them. And so they've either split to Labour because they're really concerned about economic concerns, or they've split to Reform because they're actually more concerned about immigration concerns.
Mm. Before we move on to your analysis of what's happened in the most recent election, I just want to stay with the rationale around the shocks that you mentioned that caused the volatility in 2017. So you've gone through Brexit, the immigration, the EU enlargement, which is the cause of the immigration really at its core, the economic crash. Two of the other things you mentioned were Scottish independence and the coalition of the Lib Dems and Tories. Maybe on that one, you could talk me through why that was such an influencer of volatility.
The coalition. It's one of those things that we would call an endogenous shock, in the sense that it's purely a creation of what the parties did. It's not really some external force like immigration or financial collapse. Mm. And all it did, of course, is it basically rather dramatically transformed Britain from a party system where you're seeing spreading out votes to the Liberal Democrats who were doing quite well, very, very well. And then that imploded completely. And so it became pretty much a two-party system again, especially after Theresa May effectively squeezed out UKIP by stealing their clothes on Brexit. Even though she wasn't in the end very successful on that, she did in 2017 steal all those UKIP voters for the Conservatives. So even though Jeremy Corbyn, for example, and this is one of the weird things about the British system that Irish voters may not be completely aware of, Keir Starmer is just one of, you know, an unbelievably large majority.
And a fairly insignificant increase in his vote.
No, it's a decline. I mean, there are fewer voters voting for Keir in 2024 than there were voting for Jeremy Corbyn in 2019.
I thought the Labour had increased it just by 1%, but they went down.
That's because there was a massive drop in turnout.
Okay, that's right.
You saw turnout drop from 67 to 59. So actually, in real votes, Jeremy Corbyn, and of course in 2017, he won phenomenally large amounts of votes, but in 2019, still more popular than Keir Starmer. And yet we have this remarkably transformed political system because of certain sorts of key voters who switch, and probably most importantly, because Reform UK just split the right. And once you do that, you end up with what Britain had back in the 80s, where we had the SDP, the Social Democrats, coming in and competing with Labour, because Labour was struggling with more or less far left or centre left issues, and guaranteed Mrs. Thatcher and the Conservatives a victory for several elections. That's the way these things work. And the boot's on the other foot now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was so fascinating to go through those figures last week after the UK election. And what struck me was it doesn't really, well, that does matter, but it's not what the amount of votes that you get. It's clearly where you get those votes that make you successful in terms of returning the seats. And that's what they concentrated on. So what's your analysis of how things have changed or how things have developed since you looked at this comprehensively and comparing it against what we've seen last week in the general election?
Well, in a sense, what we say in the book is simply that now voters are up for grabs in a way they've never been before. So when something new comes along, and what we've seen since then is COVID, obviously, and the COVID for a while didn't really have a big impact because the parties were fairly consensual. And it wasn't. It's only after the core of COVID went through, and we saw all the Partygate stuff and things like that, and then the Ukraine crisis and cost of living crisis. You could argue that cost of living plus Ukraine equals a new shock, which is basically, and what that has done is just stripped the Tories of 20% of their vote, and they only had 42% to start off with, so they lost half their vote, which is the sort of change you could never have imagined. However bad things were, say 40 or 50 years ago, that level of change didn't exist, especially for the Conservatives, who are used to being, on the whole, more often than not, the most numerically dominant party. And so what we've seen is a continuation of what we wrote then in many respects. And we've got another book, which we should be releasing soon, although we've now got to add 2024 to it, and basically looking at how the realignment that occurred over that period in response to the sorts of changes in what the parties have dealt with and how they've dealt with them and the messages they've sent, it's actually surprisingly still there, hidden underneath the surface to a fair degree. Because although, say, working class people who might have shifted to Tories on Brexit have now flowed back to a substantial degree to Labour, middle class people have also done that. So you've seen, it's what the technical term they use in the business is, like, valence. It's competence. A competent shock, as it were, will just lead to everybody, whatever their ilk, fleeing from the perceived incompetent leader party. Not always the leader party's fault. Obviously, the government has had to deal with Ukraine and various other things, which in COVID, Boris Johnson must have thought he'd top of the world. He got to be prime minister. And then a thing came along that not many people knew how to deal with. And the Conservatives have still suffered from the ramifications of what happened there. More shocks, more massive switches of voters.
That's very interesting about the realignment when you put it that way. And then the competence question, which is obviously always core to government when it comes to you trusting people to kind of get you out of messes. And when you look at the Conservative Party, Liz Truss and Boris Johnson, do you feel that there's a period of time to wash that incompetence, if you like, out of the Tory party system? Or do you feel now that we have Reform and Nigel Farage actually elected this time, that they could build and drive the Conservative Party more toward the right to speak to that part of the party instead of going back to the middle ground?
Well, this again is the biggie, isn't it? It's like, back in 2001 or so, I mean, there was a lot of talk about the Tory party putting what they called clear blue water between them and Tony Blair's dominant Labour Party. And they argued and split around on that for a few years while Blair just won election after election until the financial crisis of 2008, which saw, of course, Gordon Brown lose the next election. So what we've got now is probably a far more extreme version of that. And it's more extreme because they've lost so many of the people who led the party and were candidates for leadership. Mm. And the ones that were left, to some degree, tend to be more, as far as I can see, on the right, the Kemi Badenochs and that, who are obviously now tearing into each other in order to position themselves. Now, if the Conservatives do, I mean, I just, honestly, if they do go to a more populist, as they would call it, right-wing position, in an attempt to block off Nigel Farage, say, I personally think it would be a bit of a disaster for them because there just aren't enough votes there to really challenge for the core middle ground. Once you shift off to the fringes, on whatever, I mean, fringe is probably a bit of a strong word, but yeah, once you shift off away from the centre ground, you're going to really make yourself a whole lot of trouble in the British electoral system. Mm. And then it could take one or two more elections for that to be resolved. Mm. Their only hope is that Keir Starmer's government, unlike Tony Blair's government, who inherited a really good economy and all sorts of positive things, are really brought low by the disastrous economic circumstances and the growth issues that they face and the massive spending that's required to keep infrastructure in good shape. So, but if they switch off to becoming a populist party, to beat Farage. They might beat Farage off, but yet again, they will probably lose substantially for one or two more elections. Mm.
Well, certainly the Labour Party do not have an easy road ahead of them and already significantly trying to temper expectations of what they can and they can't do. Geoffrey, I'm afraid time is upon us and I'd love to talk to you more about what's happening in the British system specifically, but maybe when you have your next piece of research out, you come back and talk to us again.
Love to. That'd be great.
That was Geoffrey Evans of Newfield College, Oxford, talking to Taking Stock. Thank you very much for being with us today, Geoffrey.
Thanks a lot.
After the break, we'll ask where NATO is.
Mike Tirico here with some of the 2024 Team USA athletes. What's your message for the team of tomorrow?
To young athletes, never forget why you started doing it in the first place. You have to pursue something that you're passionate about.
Win, lose, or draw, I'm always going to be the one having a smile on my face.
Finding joy in why you do it keeps you doing it.
Be authentic, be you, and have fun.
Joy is powering Team USA during the Olympic and Paralympic Games. Comcast is proud to be bringing that inspiration home for the team of tomorrow.
You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, NATO leaders met this week for a summit commemorating the 75th anniversary of their military alliance. But with the challenges in the form of an aggressive China, the Israeli assault on Gaza and the war in Ukraine, we're going to look at the commitment of some of the key allies that's coming under question this week. And joining me now to discuss all of this, I'm delighted to say that Alex Markward is with me. He's from CNN. He is the chief national security correspondent, but many of our listeners will know him as a regular presenter of the Situation Room, also from his election coverage and, of course, that famous coverage that he did of the insurrection on January the 6th. Alex, you're very welcome to News Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, you'll know, Alex, that a lot of our listeners here, and you'll know from our own Donny O'Sullivan over there, a lot of our listeners here in Ireland pay huge attention to CNN. So we're delighted to get your take on what happened around the NATO summit this week. The anniversary and how they presented it was quite the theatrical show. President Biden committing more air defence in his speech, the NATO chief getting the Medal of Freedom. And it started, so I suppose, a broader look at NATO's position in the world in 2024. Before we get into where that is now, maybe start us off by how NATO started and why.
Well, there's no mystery as to why the 75th anniversary was held here. It's because the NATO Charter was signed here in 1949 at the Mellon Auditorium. With far fewer members, of course, and now the NATO alliance is celebrating the addition of two more members this year, Sweden and Finland, bringing the number to 32. And it, of course, started as, you know, a way to rally Western countries, to bind them together, in essence, to confront the then Soviet threat. And this is an alliance that has blossomed to almost three dozen countries now. And it is obviously it has been critical in terms of you know, its responses and its ability to thwart threats from around the world, primarily because of what is known as Article 5, which is arguably the most important part of the NATO Charter, which says that an attack on one country is an attack on all. Now, it's really just been invoked one time after the 9/11 attacks on the United States. And then shortly thereafter, we saw the invasion of Afghanistan and the U.S. and other NATO allies rallying to their side to confront that threat. So this was already going to be a historic summit marking the 75th anniversary and the transfer of power, if you will, from one secretary general to the other, with Jens Stoltenberg leaving and Mark Rutte coming in. But there are some critical issues that are being discussed there as well. It's not just pomp and ceremony. And then, of course, it comes at a very interesting time for us here in the U.S. politically.
Absolutely. Now, one of the issues that brought NATO into the headlines in recent years was the issue of funding. There was a piece in last weekend's Financial Times, I don't know whether you got to see it, but it was about 2018 and the NATO summit that Trump attended, where he started to bring in the funding issue as a question. And President Biden, in his speech earlier this week about the funding, said that more countries than ever before were committing to the 2%. That's the requirement of membership of NATO. Do you think that that's a strong enough signal that the commitment is there? Or is there an element of all of this that they're kind of future-proofing it just to secure their position ahead of a possible return of Donald Trump in November?
Well, I think it's no mistake that we heard Jens Stoltenberg just a few weeks ago on a trip to Washington before this summit, trumpeting the fact that now 23 countries, I believe it is, have reached that 2% threshold. That is a non-binding requirement, but that is the expectation. And there are, you know, a minority of countries, about a third of the countries, that have not reached that threshold. Canada, perhaps foremost among them, among the biggest ones, at least. And so I think Stoltenberg was trying to send the message to Trump and others that that NATO countries are really stepping up. We also saw the National Security Advisor from the U.S., Jake Sullivan, writing the other day in the New York Times about how many European countries have stepped up their defense spending. So obviously the U.S. would still like to see other countries stepping up. But I think, you know, we have heard Trump railing against NATO for many countries not paying their dues, as he puts it. That's not really how it works. They're supposed to spend 2% of their GDP on defense funding. But that really is one of the way that the alliance is trying to sort of future-proof themselves by stepping up and increasing their defense spending at a time when there are these enormous threats, not just from Russia in Ukraine, but also confronting China in the Indo-Pacific.
And just talking about China, NATO called China a decisive enabler of Russia's war against Ukraine. Its stance on that, to me, I suppose, was a little beyond what we've heard before. Were you surprised at the tone of the comments that they made on China? Maybe you'll just talk us through why you think NATO are making those comments at the moment, how significant the threat from China is.
Surprised, yes and no. I will say that, you know, when we're looking at this NATO communique, which is this declaration that they put out at the end of every NATO summit, the focus has pretty much been on Ukraine and what the alliance would say about Ukraine's future in NATO. And they're going to be saying that Ukraine is on an irreversible path. So that was really the focus in the lead up to the summit. So I'm surprised that the language that they included about China was as strong as it was, and I think it took China off guard. As you noted, they said that China has become a decisive enabler of Russia's war in Ukraine. You know, just a few years ago, the language about China was pretty broad and bland, if it was in there at all. And now it's really quite pointed. about their role in enabling Russia's war. But the reason I'm not surprised is because this is the kind of language that we've heard from Jens Stoltenberg, from President Biden, from other NATO leaders about Beijing's role in supporting Russia's efforts in Ukraine. And so this is the kind of thing we hear fairly regularly. But the fact that it has become such a central part of what NATO is talking about really does highlight how they are seeing the Chinese threat. And we should note that at this NATO alliance, it's not just NATO leaders. There are leaders from Australia, from New Zealand, from South Korea and Japan who are also participating. And that really does drive home the fact that as we sit here and really highlight what they're doing about Ukraine, that China is very much a priority at the summit as well.
Indeed, yeah. Mentioning Ukraine there, that was quite a significant part of President Biden's speech. And they committed a lot more in terms of money for Ukraine and defenses. Maybe talk us through what exactly they're doing there.
Yeah, the Ukrainians for a long time have been really pleading with their allies to send more air defenses. And we really saw why it's so needed on Monday, right before the summit started, when Russia launched a huge series of attacks all across Ukraine with all kinds of missiles, hypersonic, ballistic, cruise missiles. The most notable strike was on the biggest children's hospital in Ukraine, in Kyiv, in the capital. And that really did highlight the need for these air defenses. And so President Biden, in his opening speech on Tuesday, said that the U.S. would be sending, U.S. and allies would be sending more Patriot missile systems as well as other air defense systems. Those are very much needed in Ukraine. The second big item that was mentioned the day after are F-16s, which President Zelensky has been asking for a long time. Secretary of State Antony Blinken saying that those will be in the skies over Ukraine by this summer. And that those are also those are being given by Denmark and the Netherlands with U.S. Support, of course. Now, I should note that those are two very valuable pieces of kit when it comes to defending themselves and attacking Russia. Neither of them, I should note, will be game changers in this war. But what it does do is send a strong message to Vladimir Putin that the alliance will continue to support Ukraine, that support isn't going anywhere, and that Putin cannot wait out the alliance. Of course, the question then becomes what happens in November if President Biden is no longer leading the U.S. and leading the NATO alliance.
Yeah. And again, President Biden, you know, sending a message out to the American people almost as well that NATO supported them, as you mentioned earlier, invoking Article 5 after 9/11 happened. And really, you know, I thought trying to reach out on his international policy to the public directly in America to say there's value in this for America as well. You're the national security correspondent for CNN, and you're no stranger to politics, as I said at the top of this interview. Maybe just that issue you mentioned about the outcome of the US November election. How has that presided over this conference?
Well, it is weighing heavy on everyone's mind, and that would have been the case regardless of Joe Biden's performance at the CNN debate just 2 weeks ago. But now that you see all this general freak out, if you will, among Democrats about President Biden, that has added to the skittishness, if you will, the jumpiness by the NATO leaders who are here. It's no mystery that they would rather see President Biden win in the fall because he is much more pro-NATO than Trump is. NATO is very much a cornerstone of U.S. foreign policy for Joe Biden and would not be the case under President Trump if he were to win again. Trump has talked about NATO with a fair bit of disdain and is tepid at the very least. I mean, he's talked about allowing Russia to do, quote, whatever the hell they want to NATO allies if they don't reach that spending level that we were just discussing. So there's a lot of concern. There would have been anyway because it's such a tight race. There is more concern now because of the domestic and political conversation that we're having in the United States. And I think there's a bit of regret also among the diplomats who I've spoken with because that political conversation is overshadowing so much of the important work that is being done here. And everyone I've spoken to has driven home the point that despite that conversation, despite it being distracting, the work of NATO is proceeding. And at the end of the day, this will be a successful summit. There's very little mystery about what happens at these summits because so much is choreographed and pre-planned. But I think there is a little bit of frustration, at least, that that the conversation and the worry is distracting from the very important work. But as President Zelensky said in his opening remarks, everybody is watching November, including Vladimir Putin. Everyone is watching this U.S. election because it has such important consequences.
Do you think that the NATO summit would have got this much attention? Like, honestly, this is getting so many headlines over here in Europe and in the UK, notwithstanding everything that's happening. Maybe an awareness of geopolitics has risen in all our psyche because of what's happening on the margins of Europe in Ukraine. But do you think that NATO, a NATO summit, even a celebration 75 years, would get this type of attention were it not for the drama surrounding what's happening President Biden at the moment?
It's a great question. And the answer is probably not. And probably because of the reasons that I just mentioned that, you know, so much of what happens at a NATO summit, we kind of know is going to happen. These discussions are important, but it's rare that there are surprises. I don't know that we would be paying as much attention. I think that the bigger challenge would have been to convince the populations of these NATO countries that it is important to continue to support Ukraine. And these NATO leaders are struggling in a very large way to convince their people that we must continue to support Ukraine because Ukraine is not making much progress on the battlefield, it must be said. I mean, they're holding the line, but it is getting to a point where it is very much a frozen conflict. And so there are bigger and bigger questions about how long is that support going to last. And so the real efforts can often be domestic and to be showing the folks back home, the voters back home, that we are undertaking these very important tasks. But I completely agree with you that we are watching this NATO summit very, very carefully. And we're watching President Biden in particular because of the concerns about him and his political fate. And I can tell you that all of the diplomats at the conference, at the summit, are watching just as closely as concerned Democrats, as concerned Americans. They really want to see what is going on and try to figure out what may happen.
Yeah, really high stakes. Look, Alex, before I let you go, I just have one quick question for you. Look, I recall your report of the Capitol Hill riots and how you were surrounded. And at that time and on that report, you were quite shaken by it. But you mentioned that you've covered these type of events overseas in many different countries, but that seeing it in your own country was sort of, I don't think these were the words used, but like soul destroying. How do you feel about things now as we head into another election, which most people are saying here, at least, might see Donald Trump return to the White House?
It was a really disturbing event, and it was certainly one of the most shocking and life-changing moments for me, certainly my career. You know, I think as an American correspondent, when you go to a country like Egypt, for example, where I covered the Arab Spring, or Turkey, where I've covered a lot of protests, you're able to remove yourself a little bit because it's not as personal, and you're there for work, and you're able to sort of focus on the work at hand. And it certainly can be upsetting when you're attacked there or roughed up or shouted at as well. But to have that happen in the U.S., 2 miles from my house, and being shouted at in a language that is my own, it was really, really quite upsetting. And to see that the Capitol attacked that way was something that I never thought would necessarily be possible. And I really don't think that anger has dissipated. In fact, I think it's probably grown. I think the divisions that we saw now almost 4 years ago have only deepened. I'm very, very concerned. I do think there's a lot of at stake in this election. I don't know if something like that will necessarily repeat itself literally, but it's very, very worrying, and it's something that still weighs on me quite a bit.
Well, look, let's hope it does not repeat itself. Alex, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us here on News Talk today. That was Alex Mark Ward, who is the CNN Chief National Security Correspondent. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate you having me.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks once again to all of today's guests for their very valuable time. Thank you also to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy. Simon Keane and Stephen Daunt were on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, please do get in touch with us. You can email takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton is up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC.
On News Talk.